Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes from Spectator TV, recorded on Thursday, November the 26th. On this week's show, we'll give you a detailed breakdown of the Chancellor's spending review, take a look at the return of England's lockdown tier system, and we explain how to overcome vaccine skepticism as we look to the next phase in the pandemic. I'll also be talking to Ivan Rogers. He was the UK's former permanent representative to the EU. So maybe he can tell us just what the holdup is with the Brexit deal. It's just over a month away till the end of the year. We also have a special offer for you this week. If you subscribe to The Spectator in our weekend flash sale, you'll get 12 weeks of the magazine in print and online for just £12. And we'll also send you a bottle of Johnnie Walker Black Label Scotch Whiskey. Worth £30, absolutely free, if you subscribe. So to become a subscriber today, go to spectator.co.uk/flash sale. That's spectator.co.uk/sale. Now hurry, because this offer ends on Monday. Now, as always, a special thanks to Charles Stanley for supporting this week's episode of The Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms and one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange. So, British politics. This week, the Chancellor told us just how big a chunk COVID has taken out of the British economy, showed how we're heading for a national debt of almost £3 trillion. Yes, trillion, £3 trillion, powered by a budget deficit of almost £400 billion this year alone. And he indicated the possible paths to economic recovery. Nothing on tax rises, very little on spending cuts. Let's go to our economic editor, Kate Andrews, with an overview of the latest numbers. Kate.
Thanks, Andrew. Alongside the Chancellor's spending review this week, we got the economic forecasts from the Office for Budget Responsibility. These are updated predictions, taking into account data and happenings over the past few months, particularly as it relates to COVID-19. And as you can see from this first slide here, I'm not sure I need to tell our audience this. If you've been living through these lockdowns, firebreakers, circuit breakers, you know that the economy is in a dire state. But I think these charts really focus the mind, and we can see here that the economy is now set to contract 11.3% this year. That is the biggest fall in 300 years. And when you get to 2025, the economy is now set to be 3% smaller than it was originally forecast to be in the March budget. And what this means in simple terms is that for the medium future, the UK is going to be less wealthy and less prosperous than it was set to be before. And on to this next slide on recovery, it's a long path back to pre-COVID levels. We're not set to get there now until the fourth quarter of 2022. That is in 2 years' time. Now, some have said that these forecasts are too pessimistic, and the reasons that they're citing is that, number one, they don't take into account the update of the Oxford vaccine, which came after these forecasts were put together. And they've also noted that they're based on the idea that restrictions will lift in the summer of 2021. And given the positive vaccine news that we've had these past few weeks, we're hearing that it could actually be in the spring. So I think there are reasons to think that, you know, perhaps it could look a bit rosier than what I'm presenting to you here. But I would flag two things. The first is that the OBR hasn't taken into account the Oxford vaccine, but they have taken into account Pfizer and Moderna, and make very clear in the document that they laid out that vaccines have been taken into account, at least that optimism that there could be a way out of this in 2021. And as well, when we're talking about the lifting of restrictions, let's remember what that meant this year. It didn't mean that life went back to normal over the summer. It meant that you could now legally see 30 people, as opposed to perhaps just somebody in your bubble. So I think when we're talking about restrictions and when they loosen, it's not obvious at all yet how long the vaccine program is going to take to create, how long it will take to inoculate, the percentage of people needed to get to some level of herd immunity. Hopefully it's sooner rather than later, but I think we're really in the dark on a lot of those questions. So I wouldn't throw out these forecasts and just say they're far too pessimistic. I wouldn't necessarily say they're optimistic either. There are a lot of outstanding questions, but just some rebuttals to some of the complaints about the forecast this week. On to the next slide. Perhaps this is the most optimistic thing from the OBR. It's still pretty painful, if we're going to be honest. But they have revised their unemployment projections. In July, they thought unemployment would hit a peak of 11.9%. That's 3.5 million people throughout next year. Now they think by summer 2021, it will be 7.5%. That's 2.5 million people. Still a huge jump from where we are now, but significantly less than originally predicted. It's an important reminder that, you know, we have the furlough scheme. It's not set to come to an end until next March. Many businesses are still hobbling along, but we know there are going to be more business closures over the winter months. And we have not yet felt that real economic pain or that looming unemployment crisis, which we know is growing closer. And how are we paying for all of it? We're paying quite a lot. We are now forecast to spend nearly £400 billion this year. And I think what's most notable about this chart here isn't that massive spike that you see, but what happens after. It is very clear now that our spending this year is not a one-off. It's not set to be £400 billion again, but by the time we get to 2025, the UK's deficit is still estimated to be hovering around £100 billion. And that means that the Chancellor is going to have a lot of difficult questions to answer and perhaps some trade-offs to make in the coming year and after. And on this last slide, so we're spending all of this money, but what are we spending it on? And that brings me to our last slide on the changes in day-to-day departmental spending limits for next year. The Chancellor has already spent £280 billion on the COVID crisis. That is set to increase by £56 billion next year. Core day-to-day spending is actually set to reduce by £10 billion compared to what the March budget had calculated. But in cash terms, we're looking at a nearly £15 billion increase, with money going to health and education. And I think this is where things get a bit sticky. As economists on the left and the right agree that COVID should, if it can be treated as a one-off. Interest rates are extremely low. It's not too expensive to service that debt. But the Chancellor is going to have to tackle that day-to-day spending at some point, especially as he tries to get the finances in order. Trade-offs are going to have to be made. He has not said where yet. He's barely even scratched the surface as to what he might try to do. It's very difficult. We're in the dark about what might need to be spent next year still. But those questions are coming, and he'll probably start to answer them next year at some point, perhaps even towards the end of the year.
James, the Chancellor bases his statement on the forecasts given by the Office for Budget Responsibility. But these forecasts you can take with a pinch of salt. The fact is, it's never looked more uncertain. Next year could be far better than he's talked about, or it could be far worse. So he's kind of kept, when it comes to tax or spending cuts, he's kind of kept his powder dry.
Yeah, I think this is essentially was a holding statement. There is, I mean, as you say, Andrew, there is just so much uncertainty about next year. Let's imagine that the Oxford vaccine is approved by the regulator. Let's imagine that the rollout goes smoothly. And, you know, on just before Easter, at the beginning of April, Boris Johnson announces that all the COVID coronavirus restrictions are falling away. I think you could see a much stronger economic bounce back than anyone expected. You know, household balance sheets, especially in the upper deciles, have been repaired during this crisis. People have saved money. You could see a kind of big consumer-led recovery. Alternatively, as Kate said, the Oxford vaccine might not be as effective as people hope. The rollout might go more slowly, and we could see restrictions in place for longer, and we could have another bad economic year. So I think there's so much uncertainty around that what you've seen Rishi Sunak do is kind of limit the actions he's taken here. He basically had his big message was this isn't sustainable in the long term. And I think as a kind of indication that belts are going to have to be tightened, you saw the public sector pay freeze, the decision to reduce overseas aid from 0.7% of GNI to 0.5%. But I think there is a worrying sign here, which is if you look at the political backlash to those two decisions, you know, I mean, that shows you how unprepared the political class is and the Tory party is for some of these difficult decisions that are coming down the line. Because I suspect that when we get to the end of this parliament, we'll look back on those decisions as some of the easier ones to make.
Let's go to our political correspondent, Katie Bowles. In general, Katie, how did the statement, the spending review, go down with the Tory backbenchers?
So I think that there are parts of it which have been quite quickly celebrated. So this £4 billion Level Up Fund is something that members of the Northern Research Group have been waxing lyrical about. They're saying it's a clear sign to their constituents that Boris Johnson really means it when he says that he wants to level up the country. But I think on the flip side, as you say, in a way, this is a holding statement, but there are a few areas that are causing concern. I think the public sector pay freeze, broadly speaking, even if Rishi Sunak doesn't want to call it a freeze, is seen as something that in the coming months will look less harsh when you start to see all the other bad things that are about to happen in terms of looming mass unemployment, largely in the private sector. But I think where there is the most immediate Tory fight is on international aid, the overseas budget, and Rishi Sunak's decision to reduce that from 0.7 of GDP to 0.5. As soon as this was reported a few days ago, you start to see quite a coordinated effort amongst Tory grandees to try and stop this from happening. You've had, you know, countless former prime ministers come forward and say why it's a bad idea. And you've also had one ministerial resignation in the form of Liz Sugg from the Lords. And we're hearing that the One Nation caucus, and in a way this should worry the Prime Minister the most, because they can actually vote, they are sitting MPs, are saying that they want to move against this. And the problem for the government is this is going to come to a vote. I think in terms of will Rishi Sunak be able to get his way, I think the expectation in government is that they should be fine. They're hoping that all this polling suggesting actually it's very popular with their voters, particularly their core voters in the Red Wall, will be enough to get MPs to fall into line.
James, isn't this row over international aid, it just shows how Westminster is in a bubble. I would be very surprised if there's much of a row in the country as a whole.
Yeah, it's striking. If you look at the policy, you know, even Liberal Democrat, even a plurality of Liberal Democrat voters agree with the decision to reduce it to 0.5. And I think you have to look at this kind of policy in the round. This rise in international aid spending was part of the post-Cold War peace dividend. That is sadly coming to an end. If you look at the big announced increase in defence spending last week, you know, that is a sign that great power politics is back, great power competition is back. And, you know, the Western powers led by the United States, but also involving the UK, are going to have to spend more on their military. And if you're going to spend more on defence, you have to spend less on something else. And given how linked defence and development are, the obvious thing is international aid. But, you know, I think there is a row. I think there is a little bit of hypocrisy going on here. You know, three of the five prime ministers who've condemned the cut never met the target when they were in office.
Katie, you mentioned the Tory grandees and the Labour grandees do have all been shouting about it, against it. Most of them, when they were in power, didn't get near 0.7% of GDP. But let me park that. What you did say quite rightly is that it's the backbenchers that matter. Is there a big enough head of steam among existing backbenchers? As you said, they're the ones that have votes to derail this because they can count on Labour and Lib Dem support, I'm pretty sure. Or will it get through?
So I think it's in the air, you know, it's up in the air right now, because if you look at the One Nation caucus, technically speaking, they have enough members to demolish Boris Johnson's majority of 80. However, not all those members are the most earnest or, you know, the most devoted to the cause. And therefore, you have very loud opponents of this plan, Damien Green, who leads that group, Andrew Mitchell, the former international, you know, foreign aid secretary, and they're making the case. But I think there's a strong sense in government that they will be able to whittle this rebellion down. They think they are going to be able to get this, you know, below 40. It's going to be okay in that sense. And I think one of the reasons is part what you're touching on, which is the fact that they're not expecting a public backlash across the country, which means MPs are going to be besieged with messages saying, why are you cutting international aid? Such as you had in the case of Free School Meals or Barnard Castle. So they think that in a way, there's not going to be that pressure building in the same way. And that means actually it should be more dealable. However, it's worth just adding the caveat that the government whip's office hasn't always got things right in recent months. And there are lots of people who would quite like that team to be shaken up for that very reason.
Very well, I shall keep that in mind. Kate, two questions. First, you mentioned that the OBR's projections, on which the Chancellor bases his spending forecasts, didn't take into account the most recent good news about the Oxford vaccine. But am I right in thinking that the OBR came out with four scenarios, one very grim, the central forecast, and then a more optimistic one, which, and it's a lot of it's to do with when lockdown ends. And in the optimistic one, lockdown ends more quickly, which it may be able to do because of the Oxford and other vaccines. So if we want to see what impact the Oxford vaccine could have, we should take the optimistic forecast to see.
Yes, and that's what the OBR hinted at yesterday, noting that it did have more optimistic, more pessimistic scenarios, and we should now lean towards the optimistic ones. But everybody is very hesitant to say this is how it's going to be, because nobody knows. And as mentioned, vaccines were accounted for in all of these scenarios. It's just the question of whether or not Oxford could be transformative, especially in the UK, where we have plenty of doses to go around, far more than the UK would actually need. That might hurry up the process in which we all get inoculated. Restrictions are eased faster. But, you know, this is going to be a huge undertaking from the NHS, one it really has never had to do before. We're all very optimistic, but we don't know what it's going to look like yet. We still don't know how effective the vaccine actually is, especially for those who perhaps are most vulnerable to this virus. So these are the outstanding questions, and the reason that we call them predictions and the reason that they are so frequently updated, I have absolutely no doubt that this will be shifting next year as well. And let's hope in that positive direction, but nobody's ready to commit to say that will certainly be the case.
And my second question to you, Kate, is that the Chancellor mentioned that once the COVID business is dealt with, the government needs to move to what he called a sustainable fiscal position. But am I right in thinking that there was no hint yesterday of what that would mean in practice? No hint of what the Sunak fiscal rules will be. He's just not telling us anything about that so far.
No, he's not. And I think that's very intentional. If he even begins to signal that he may bring in tax rises, that he may be quite strict with his fiscal rules, that could be extremely damaging to an economy that's on its knees. In many ways, that could be its death sentence. So I think it's very understandable that the Chancellor is hesitant to commit to what he plans to do. And we know that he has a broad set of options. He could be looking at tax increases. He could be looking at spending cuts. He could be looking at more pro-growth policies. If anything, I'm surprised that we haven't seen a few more of those yet. Perhaps make it cheaper and easier for employers, for example, to hire new staff. That would be a great step in the right direction to tackle the unemployment crisis that looms. But these are the decisions he wants to make next year. And in all fairness, it's very difficult with such a changing landscape and updates happening so constantly for him really to know how much more money, for example, the government's going to have to spend on this crisis, how many more billions of pounds he's going to have to account for eventually. But I think the sticking point for the Chancellor isn't so much the COVID spending, which economists on the left and the right really want to treat as a one-off spending spree, but this day-to-day spending that he's increasing. We've started to see him hint towards the fact that will have to be accounted for by taking away £4 billion from foreign aid, and then he announces £4 billion for a levelling up pot. He didn't draw the exact comparison, but you can put one and one together. There may be more trade-offs in our future. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that there will be more trade-offs in our future. But as Katie and James point out, look at the huge backlash to those trade-offs that he's making. I think a lot of people out there are just not willing to admit yet. They're not willing to allow themselves to think about a world where we have to make these difficult decisions, because they are going to be painful.
So James, final question to you. He's kind of very tentatively indicated that there needs to be cuts, hence the reduction in international aid and a pause or freeze in at least part of the public sector. And he's reduced departmental budgets overall by about 13 billion in the year after next year. So we know there has to be some kind of cuts. Now, you could say, I see some people saying, well, we'll get a better idea of tax rises and spending cuts in the March budget. But I wonder whether the picture will be that clearer by March. It could be, tell me if I'm wrong, we may have to wait till March budget of 2022 before we know what the tax rises are going to be and the spending cuts.
So I think by March, we will know whether all the COVID restrictions are going to fall away in April or not. So we will know that much, but we won't know how strong the economic rebound has been. So I think that is the question. I mean, this also, don't forget the kind of electoral timetable here, which is, you know, you obviously don't want to choke off the recovery by moving too early towards a fiscal consolidation. But I also think that, you know, the next election is going to be in 2023 or 2024. I think you want to have got this out of the way before then. I don't think you want to fight an election with fiscal consolidation kind of hanging over your shoulder. I also think that the one of the lessons that the Tory party learned from 2017 is they have to have a fiscal dividing line with Labour. In that election, they didn't, and they couldn't even land a blow on Jeremy Corbyn's kind of madcap spending plan. So I think there is a recognition that they have to have some kind of fiscal dividing line with Labour before the next election.
Right, let's move on. COVID is still with us. Some of the case numbers rising in a lot of different countries too, and the deaths rising as well. In England, the tier system has returned today. It was announced just as we started recording this. It will dominate the headlines for the rest of the day and all into tomorrow. Everywhere in England, except for the Isle of Scilly, the Isle of Wight, and Cornwall, are in tier two or three. Only these three places are in tier one. And this will take us up to Christmas, as I understand it. There'll then be a five-day easing. And then it looks like we'll then go back into the tiers two and three for over 98% of the country. Katie, something really surprising happened today when the government announced that the new tier system was up on the website. The website crashed. I mean, who's ever heard of a government website crashing?
Yes, we're truly shocked by the failure of government and technology. and it did mean that you were beginning to see a struggle to work out which tier, you know, which place was in. There's some tweets going out which weren't actually so true when people could actually get through. But as you say, very few areas in tier one. I think there's going to be some people in quite, you know, rural areas wondering why they're suddenly in tier two when they weren't in tier two before the lockdown. But this goes to something Boris Johnson was telling Tory MPs last night, which, you know, these are going to be very strict. He's insisting they have to be this strict because the advice he received previously from the scientists who advise him was that the tier system was not enough in itself to prevent the spread of infection, which is why it has had to be bulked up. You've got that 16th of December review date, and I think that is aimed to give people some hope that if everyone does abide by the rules, things could be relaxed a little bit more before the Christmas period, before the Christmas bubbles. Because I think one thing they are really quite worried about, or at least a lot of Tory MPs are worried about, is that people have just been living under severe restrictions in terms of a national lockdown in England for 4 weeks now. So are they going to take well to be putting in tier three and keep abiding by the rules? There's a sense you need a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. Is the Christmas bubble going to be enough to motivate people?
I think, James, there must be some worry that the loosening of things over the Christmas period will inevitably lead to a rise in cases once the Christmas relaxation's out of the way, and probably an increase in deaths as well, which is why should we not expect tiers two and three to continue to cover 98% of the country?
Yeah, and I think that the likely traffic after Christmas is going to be from two to three rather than from three to two. We know that the government scientific advisors thought that for every day of easing you had over Christmas, you'd have to have 5 days of tighter restrictions. The Canadian experience, they have their Thanksgiving in early October. You know, they were averaging more than 2,000 cases a day. Admittedly, the cases were going up beforehand, before their Thanksgiving celebrations. They're now averaging more than 4,500 cases a day. So that there is clearly a risk involved in this Christmas easing. And I think what you will see is more politicians following Nicola Sturgeon's lead. Nicola Sturgeon is saying, look, we have eased these rules up, but, you know, please don't take advantage of them. You know, you'll be able to have a big Easter celebration, maybe go for a Christmas Day walk rather than having a Christmas Day dinner. You've had Jason Leach, the Scottish equivalent of Chris Whitty, saying, you know, take your own serving bowls. Don't share the roast potatoes around the table. I think you will see a big urging from politicians to say, look, we have relaxed these rules, but please, you know, consider not taking advantage of of the relaxation. But I think this is going to be, I think we know that government have always worried the most about February. That is generally the most difficult month for the NHS. And so I think that it's unlikely, unless political pressure forces it, that we're going to see much relaxation before the end of Feb.
What you were describing there, Jim, just sounds like a normal, joyous Scottish Christmas. Nobody really knows the difference. I'm also puzzling why the Canadians have Thanksgiving, since I didn't think Plymouth Rock.
It's the Canadian version of Harvest Festival, essentially.
Oh, it's what we have as the Harvest Festival. So it's basically they pinched that from us.
Yeah, empire loyalists that they are, they carried on the practices.
Very well. Kate, I thought it was interesting that this time in the announcement of the tiers, there was no negotiation, no endless talk between local authorities and central government. It was done by fiat, and there's money comes with it, but it's not for negotiation. If you're in tier three, you get £4 a head for your region. And if you're in tier two, you get £2 a head. It was just, this is what's happening. No negotiation.
I think a few key things have changed. First, the government made very clear that there wasn't going to be any change to the tier system for a specific area. They had major issues around gyms and other kinds of venues that they could be open in one area of tier three and they couldn't in the other. And they've just said these tiers are what they are, regardless of where you are. So that's cut out some of the negotiations. And of course, now we have the furlough scheme extended to the end of March. And when certain areas were being put under tougher restrictions, we didn't have the furlough scheme extended in its most generous form in that way. It did still exist, but not as generous as it is now. So I think that there's less negotiation to be done simply because whilst it is by no means an ideal situation for businesses that are forced to stay closed, in fact, many are saying that they just don't think they're going to be viable into the new year, they are in a situation where they can continue to pay their staff up to 80% of their pay with a cap on that all the way through March. And of course, the government is starting to make some changes that seem quite reasonable. They're talking about mass testing as a way to reduce quarantine times, not just if you're traveling, but also if you're in close contact with somebody who's tested positive for COVID-19. And so hopefully those quite sensible updates using testing as a way to get out of quarantine and self-isolation will allow people to go about their daily lives a bit more. So even though the tiers have gotten stricter, and I think there are still some inconsistencies in a lot of these rules, for example, you still have the 11 p.m. curfew, which we never had any meaningful scientific backing for. Sage says that it has minimal impact. I think they're going to have to continue to look at these rules, how sustainable they are, but things have changed and they've made it more uniform, so there is less discussion to be had.
Katie, now that almost over 98% of the countries of England is either in tier two or tier three, what's the mood of the lockdown skeptics on the Tory backbenches?
It's not particularly good. You have various groups that have formed to try and fight lockdown measures. And I think that there is a real sense that they're not really getting much traction at the moment. I think they face a more uphill struggle because of the vaccine news. Now, there are lots of very agitated Tory MPs. I think that's going to grow now that they are seeing the tears, because there's a frustration, I think, earlier in the week, Boris Johnson, addressing from 10 Downing Street because he was in quarantine, used that statement to talk about how lockdown would end, something that he and his team thought would be good news, and how there was vaccine news, which meant you could perhaps return to normal by the spring, which they thought was good news. But yet all lots of Tory MPs heard was, you want us to be under severe restrictions all the way till March and maybe beyond. And actually the questions were pretty hostile to the Prime Minister. It wasn't helped by the fact his connection went down and Matt Hancock had to step in. He's a bit too Tiggerish for this lot, I think.
With government IT, surely, Katie, you exaggerate.
Yeah, shocking again. And then this time his tech did work at PMQs, but Lindsay Hoyle, the speaker, tried to take credit for that. So I think that you're seeing a lot of agitated MPs, and actually I think there's a misreading on both sides. I mean, the view in government is that restrictions are much more tolerable now because you have a viable exit strategy. But I don't think that that washes with quite a lot of these Conservative MPs. But what it ultimately comes down to is arithmetic. And as long as Keir Starmer is backing Boris Johnson on his lockdown measures, this group is not big enough to really stop things from going through, even if there is a vote. And although Keir Starmer may be critical of some aspects of Boris Johnson's handling of coronavirus, there's little sign that he wants to end restrictions in the way that figures such as Steve Baker might.
James, final question to you in this segment of the show. Can we discern any politics in some of the decisions of Tier 2 or Tier 3? I mean, Liverpool, you're an anti-Tory socialist town, but you cooperated with us. You were really rather nice. You're now in Tier 2. Manchester, you're in Tier 3. Take that, Andy Burnham. London, you're just too big and too important to put into Tier 3. We're going to put you into Tier 2. Is that too cynical?
Well, in the House of Commons, while we've been on air, Matt Hancock's issued a statement. He basically praised every mayor going apart from Andy Burnham. I think Liverpool is a significant one politically. Now, given Boris Johnson's history of the city, this might seem an odd thing to say, but they will hold Liverpool up as an example of, as a place where mass testing was rolled out. You know, the local authority cooperated with it. Quite a few people came forward to be tested. I mean, not as many as some people in government had hoped, but, you know, you did use these lateral flow tests to kind of speed up discovery of the cases. And that's moved from 3 to 2. And I think this will be held up as an example to places in Tier 3 to say, look, you know, the mass testing labs are coming to you. If you turn up and do your civic duty and be swabbed, you know, there's a prospect that your area will move from 3 to 2 quite quickly. I think that is what they will hold up as an example. I think London is an interesting one because if you look at it, London is in Tier 2, but, you know, you can see some signs that will point towards Tier 3. It will be interesting to see whether London manages to stay in Tier 2 in the new year.
I think your point is right. The thing we should be looking out for after Christmas is not any further relaxation, but if some of Tier 2 moves into Tier 3, and that's, I think, is a possibility, and it will bring with it some political problems for the government on its own side too. Let's leave it there for now, because there is a chance, I don't put it any higher than that, but a chance that before next year is out, lockdowns and tiers could be a thing of the past. The government has ordered enough vaccine doses for the entire British population. I'm told it's bought more per capita than any other country on earth, based on the Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca jabs. AstraZeneca, the one who worked with Oxford University on that. It seems many people, however, are reluctant about taking these vaccines that have been created in record time. Experts estimate that at least 2/3 of the population need to be vaccinated to reach herd immunity. So how can the reluctant be persuaded to take the vaccine? Stuart Ritchie is a behavioral scientist at King's College London. He takes a stab at this issue in this week's edition of The Spectator, and he joins us on Spectator TV now. Stuart Ritchie, welcome, and thank you for your time. First of all, Stuart, tell us, how widespread is this problem of vaccine skepticism, even vaccine denial?
Well, just a few months ago, the polls looked really good. 85% of people said that they would be willing to take the vaccine. And actually, interestingly, it's got worse since then. You know, as we've got closer to actually having vaccines, the polls are looking less and less good. The Pfizer poll, for instance, there was a YouGov poll showing that about 67% of people said they'd be fairly likely or very likely to take it. That's lower than what we'd need for herd immunity. There's different calculations that you have to do, of course, and it's not, you know, there isn't just one number for herd immunity, but it depends on the transmission rate of the virus and so on. But it's just about or just a bit lower than we'd really want. And also it's more complicated than that. The vaccine spreads, the virus spreads in clusters. And so we want to make sure that really much higher than the kind of basic herd immunity threshold is vaccinated. So it's quite worrying to see these polls, and we really need to do something about convincing people to take this vaccine.
There have been anti-vaxxer movements in the past. There's always a kind of hardcore of anti-vaxxers whenever vaccines come up. They seem quite militant about it. They're prone to conspiracy theories at times too. What I wonder though, Stuart, is this reluctance that you found, does this go broader than the what I might say the usual suspects when it comes to anti-vaxxers.
Yeah, I think in psychology research, behavioral science research, whatever you want to call it, they're starting to use the term vaccine hesitancy rather than anti-vaccine because there are people who are persuadable or possibly persuadable who are not just that hardcore. It does go further than that hardcore because people are worried about it. There have been incidents in the past where vaccines have been rushed and so on, and there did seem, especially in the US, to be sort of political involvement in this, trying to get the vaccine out before the election. Obviously that didn't happen, but there had, there were sort of rumors of that, and I think that all casts a really unfortunate doubt on what has been a very, very open and safe process. If you actually look at the science, the politicking has been really unfortunate.
So just to be clear on that, beyond the hardcore of people who seem to be against any kind of vaccine, there's a bigger group that is worried because this vaccine was developed so quickly.
That's clearly one aspect. I think people understandably want to see the safety data. I mean, we don't actually have full peer-reviewed papers for any of these three vaccines that we've been told about yet. They've been released in press releases, and the initial data look good. And I think the incentives are not for the vaccine companies, the pharma companies, to be, misleading us on this. I think the incentives are for them to be truthful and open about this. And they have been open about some aspects of the protocols of the studies. AstraZeneca, there's a few more questions, but Pfizer and Moderna have been amazingly transparent and open. And so I kind of look at the vaccine development as sort of a bright spot in the science on COVID, which has been very patchy overall. But I think people are understandably saying, I want to see the paper, I want to see the safety data, I want it to be assessed by the experts before I make a decision. That's fine. And I think the pharma companies should be, having absolute rocket boosters under their paper writing. They should all be writing up their papers as quickly as possible to try and convince people.
I want to come on to how you think we can nudge people to the vaccine. But before I do, let me ask a more fundamental question. Is it really just out of the question in a democracy to make the vaccine mandatory?
Well, it's not out of the question in some democracies. So some democracies nearby, for instance, France has several vaccines that are mandatory. This is in kids. The US has mandatory vaccines for going to school in many states, depends on the state. Germany has some. Australia has these no jab, no pay laws where you don't get your child benefit unless your kid has been vaccinated. So there are some countries that do either compulsory vaccination or, stop you getting your full government benefits and so on if you don't get the vaccine. It's not something we have in this country. And I actually think it's probably not going to be necessary in this case. I think there's a huge clamor to get vaccinated, and I don't think we're going to necessarily need it. I think we can use incentives, that are carrots rather than sticks.
Well, give us some examples. How would we nudge people with a carrot and perhaps with a stick towards taking the vaccine?
Well, I mean, the most obvious one is simply to pay people to take it. I think the government should be thinking very carefully about paying people, especially younger people who might think that the vaccine, it's not for us. This virus really affects older people. They're at risk of severe disease. I'm not really. I'm maybe just going to get a mild illness for a while. I think obviously that's the wrong reasoning because the virus spreads, including from younger people and including from people who don't have symptoms. And so I think the government should be thinking very carefully about paying younger people, particularly to have a vaccine. Maybe it's been suggested £200 for a shot, particularly important as well, because you might need two shots. So you might need to incentivize people to come back for the second one. And you do get a lot of attrition in these kind of interventions. So that's one thing. There are other things in the literature. The psychology literature is not particularly impressive on this topic about changing people's minds. So making people who are worried about the vaccine or are actually hardcore anti-vaccinators, making them change their mind. We're not really very good at that. We're not very good at persuasion. But there are some things, making people set specific appointments and times that they can go and get the vaccine, making sure that the clinics are easily accessible. These kind of nudges can work. But actually changing people's minds, we're just not very good at that.
Could there also be a way in which society penalizes the people who refuse to take the vaccine? For example, an airline could say, if you haven't got the vaccine, you're not flying in our airline. Or yeah, even a restaurant owner might say, if you haven't got the vaccine, you're not dining in our restaurant, which is now rather crowded.
Yeah, absolutely. There's private incentives as well. So we saw the CEO of Qantas saying that he's going to, I think he hasn't officially said, but he's thinking about it. They're considering having some kind of, so you have to show your passport for an international flight. You might also have to show your immunity passport for an international flight, and maybe even domestic flights as well. He was talking about in Australia. So I think that private companies can do this as well. And it's not just that they should do this because it's a useful thing to do for building herd immunity, but it's also, I mean, it makes people feel safer. It's going to make people want to use these companies.
James, is the government worried about vaccine skepticism? Does it feel that there'll be resistance among a decent sized chunk of the population?
I don't mean they're worried about vaccine skepticism in the first instance. I think their view is that, you know, initially the take up will be quite high. I think the worry will come if you haven't hit, we know from these leaked NHS documents, they want to hit 75% by April. And I think if you're struggling to get to that number, then I think you get into more difficult grounds of, as you said, how do you nudge people to take the vaccine? I think the problem is lots of the nudges that people talk about, like paying people to take the vaccine and the like, I think might well actually have the perverse effect of increasing people's skepticism of the vaccine.
I see what you mean, because they feel they'll be kind of bribed to do it. What do you say to that, Stuart? That's an interesting point.
Yeah, I think these backfire effects are definitely the case. I think particularly if it was compulsory, people would think, well, wait a minute, why aren't we being given a choice here? Are they hiding something about the safety of this vaccine? And particularly, you know, being paid, which is why I think the being paid thing could be directed at specific portions of the population rather than just everyone. But yeah, I think we're in a really lucky position here. The vaccine is really safe. It's the Moderna and the Pfizer ones seem to be amazingly effective, you know, 90%, 95%. And so actually, I think the aspects, the properties of the vaccine itself are reasons why we won't have to, you know, bend over backwards to get people to take it. People are going to be really desperate to take this vaccine. You know, it's not just like a routine health appointment. In this case, it's your whole world opening up again. And so I think there are reasons to be optimistic about this, although we need to think carefully and we need to be flexible too. We need to, you know, keep a real eye on those numbers and put in some new policies in place if you know, we're not getting up to that level of herd immunity.
Final issue, and I'll come to Katie then, finish off with you, Stuart, here. Katie, you've written about the question surrounding the order, the priority of who should get the vaccinations first. What's the government thinking on this yet? Is there a clear order of priority developing as government policy?
Yeah, so the government priority is pretty clear, which is the vulnerable and the aged first, as well as health workers, NHS workers. And they published documents about this. And I think that there's some questions clear about the Oxford vaccine, though there has been good news on the surface at least. But ultimately, if we're faced with a scenario where the vaccine's first approved, we have limited supplies on, and also just in terms of the choice of the highest, you know, efficacy, that will go to, you know, the 55 and overs first, as NHS workers too. However, if we are in a situation where we have limited supplies of vaccines, expect to see Tory MPs questioning the order, because there's already been some, to-ing and fro-ing from Tory MPs saying, if you can't vaccinate, you know, 75% of the country, then actually there is an argument that perhaps you vaccinate working age people first, people who need to get out there and do things, rather than vaccinate those who aren't really going to be going out there and taking part in society in such a way. And I think that debate rests on ultimately, you know, how many doses there are to go around. If Oxford is approved, it will probably diminish. And I think one other thing, just when we're talking about how you get people to take vaccines, recently there was a Tory MP who wrote on the Tory MP WhatsApp thread that perhaps MPs should be at the, you know, near the front of the queue. And they were quite quickly shot down. People suggested this would be a bad look. But there was interesting polling, I think, in the Daily Mail, which was saying that actually quite a lot of the public believe that if their MP took it first, it would give them confidence. So I think that is one to watch. Perhaps we're going to get vaccinations in the chamber.
Oh, very well. Get them live on television.
Why not?
It could replace Strictly when it comes to an end. Stuart, final question with you. what do you think the priority should be? This idea of working age people should get it first. I mean, I always thought that the natural thing to do would be people at the front line, NHS and so on, then those most vulnerable, the older, and then those with particularly with underlying comorbidities, and then those of any age with these comorbidities, and then everybody else. Is that wrong?
No, that seems very sensible to me, although there will be modeling studies that will show, I'm pretty sure that there are epidemiologists working right now on studies that will, you know, simulate different strategies that we could take. And it really all depends on the effectiveness of the vaccines too. So if this AstraZeneca vaccine is 70% effective, that's going to mean a different model from if it's 90% effective. And we really don't know the answer to that yet. So a lot of this is going to hinge on, particularly because the government has bought, you know, its largest proportion of vaccines that it's bought are the AstraZeneca ones. Wow. So it's really going to depend on how effective those vaccines are. So we really need to see from Oxford as soon as possible that paper giving all the details of all the protocol, how it was changed, if indeed it was changed, and not only that, but also the safety information. And then we can start modelling who we should be giving the vaccines to first.
Fascinating. Let's get that Oxford paper. It'd be a good scoop for the Spectator if you get it. Stuart Ritchie, King's College London, thank you for joining us, sharing your expertise with us on Spectator TV. Our final, third topic for this edition, how could it be any other? Brexit. The clock continues to tick down to December the 31st. That's when the transition period to leave the EU ends. Only 2 weeks, though, until the EU's December summit. And that's the latest time any deal can be struck. Well, probably not sensible to be too definitive about this these days. We know how the negotiators like to push things to the last minute. Let's go over to Mark Arkard, who knows all about this. I'm joined by Ivan Rogers. He worked closely with David Cameron and Theresa May on Europe, formerly the UK's permanent representative to the EU in Brussels. Ivan Rogers, welcome to Spectator TV. Thank you for joining us. Just, I know this is difficult to answer, but how would you assess the state of the talks as they stand?
Well, first of all, thanks very much for inviting me on. Look, it's very fraught. It's not surprising it's fraught. We're now coming to a crunch point where real decisions have to be taken on both sides as to where the compromise is, if there is one. I don't think we're quite there yet. It's not been moving very fast over the last few weeks. I don't think it's moved very fast this week. I think there'll be further developments this weekend. I would be surprised if there weren't, but I'm not sure we are quite yet in the final straight. My own view is that, you know, markets and indeed some of the commentators at this end have got a little bit too optimistic. Markets are pricing in about a 75 to 80% chance of a deal. I don't think it's anything like that high, because I think a number of the issues left on the table are extremely difficult to solve, but it's not insoluble.
It is interesting, though, the issues that the real sticking points that seem to be left. On one side, you've got state subsidies. We use that as a shorthand.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting that a Conservative government, which is broadly meant to be against state subsidies, is kind of hanging out for state subsidies, particularly since we use them a lot less than even the Germans. And on the EU side, it's Fish, particularly President Macron, which is important if you're in the fishing industry, but hardly central to the future of the EU or the United Kingdom.
Yes, although Fish, of course, was a massive issue on the way into the European Economic Community in 1973. So, you know, we've been here before, and on exit, the same issues arise as on. Subsidies is an odd one. I suppose what the European side might say is this isn't a classic British Conservative government. Yes, we've on the whole spent far less in terms of state subsidies than French or Germans or other core European members, and very deliberately so under both Conservative and Labour governments I've worked for. It's quite hard to argue. Obviously, we're in a different world post-COVID anyway, in terms of what this government would want to do and how it would want to do it. It's quite difficult if you look at this government from a European perspective to think of it as a classic low tax, low spend, Thatcherite government. It obviously isn't.
Indeed.
So I think there's nervousness, not just in the classic old Western European capitals, Paris and Berlin, but also in Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, about what the UK might do by way of subsidies, which sort of tilts the playing field against their own companies on their own market.
As we look back at the talks, a lot of things jump out. Let me put two that jumped out to me. I'm sure you've got many more. One is it's pretty clear to me that the British never realized how difficult it was going to be, but certainly the British politicians never realized how difficult this was going to be. And another thing that does jump out to me too is that Mr. Barnier and his team, or maybe even the EU as a whole, didn't quite clock the watershed change for the negotiations that moving from Theresa May to the Johnson government indicated, symbolized.
Yeah, I think that's right on both counts. Obviously, when I was still there in government in autumn 2016, an awful lot of ministers were not just saying publicly that this was the easiest trade negotiation in history, but they were saying that privately, and they thought it was the work of months or perhaps weeks. Some were saying days. And why did they think that? Because they thought we were aligned on day one because we'd been members for the last 45 years, and therefore our rule book was the same as the European rule book. And I kept on saying, yes, I understand that, but you've left and you wanted to leave, and you wanted to leave presumably because you wanted to diverge quite radically on that rule book because you didn't like being bound by that rule book. So the fact that you're convergent on day one doesn't really make an awful lot of difference to your negotiating opposite numbers. They want to know where you want to be on day two or day 200 or day 2000. And they assume you have some radically different destination in mind. Otherwise, why would you have left? And I think we got caught up on that. I mean, that took ages, and it was a very sterile debate within Whitehall in 2016. And we've been caught up on that for a long time. Then on the difference between Theresa May's version of Brexit and Boris Johnson's. Look, I was very early on saying, I mean, pretty much from the point I resigned, if not before the point I resigned, I never thought Theresa May's version of Brexit would succeed because I didn't see how she could get it through the House of Commons. She couldn't get it through her own party. And therefore, unless she reached out to the Labour Party and moderates in the Labour Party and had a bipartisan approach, it was always going to fail. So I was privately saying to some old friends on the European side of the table, I know you think you sort of got there with her with a deal which will fly, but I don't think it'll fly. I think it'll tank. Then when it did tank, it was less of a shock, of course, by the time they'd been through three or four iterations of her failing in the House of Commons. But then when Johnson arrives, he wants a radically different version of Brexit because he wants it to be more mid-Atlantic, more buccaneering and more divergent. And it took then some time for them to digest what that was. I think it took some time as well for the British side to digest that where they said they just wanted a bog standard, skinny free trade agreement, which looked a bit like Canada. The other side was saying, well, actually, you want something deeper than Canada on multiple issues where the Canadians don't have a major trade relationship with us. And therefore, we're still going to apply this benighted level playing field conditionality to you. And that will be a sine qua non for a duty-free, quota-free deal. So, yeah, I mean, I'm afraid this is a history, maybe you could say this is a 48-year history of misreadings of each other's politics and incentives on both sides. You could say it's a 400-year history. Certainly the last 4 or 5 years have been characterized by huge misreadings on both sides of each other's incentives, I think.
Do you agree that even if we get a deal, that it won't be Canada plus, plus, plus? We were talking on Spectator TV last week with Wolfgang Mungchamp, formerly of the Financial Times, that it's actually the best way to describe it is probably Canada dry, dry.
Yeah, I think that's much closer to the mark. I mean, in my little book of about 2 years ago, I made some jokes at the expense of Canada plus plus and said, you know, beware of any deals with loads of pluses in them, because the pluses are all the kinds of things that you wanted in addition to Canada, which the other side isn't necessarily prepared to give you. So I think it would be pretty thin, in all honesty. I mean, it won't be thin in terms of volume. It's still 600 or 700 pages long, what David Frost is in the process of negotiating with Michel Barnier. There's no such thing as a short trade treaty. I've never experienced such a thing. But yes, it won't be. It'll be much stronger, obviously, on goods than on services. That's essentially a British choice. It's an interesting choice, which dates back, you know, many years. And we wanted to be divergent on services. It'll be thinner than I think we could have negotiated and probably I would have wanted to negotiate given a free hand. But I always thought that we were leaving the single market and the customs union, because if you want to end free movement of people and end budgetary contributions and take back control of laws and borders, you are leaving the single market. If you want a sovereign and an autonomous trade policy, you can't be living in a customs union. So I always thought we would end up with a free trade agreement and said so, you know, from June the 24th, 2016. The question is, what's the substance of the trade agreement and how deep or how shallow do you want to go?
Is there a possibility, I don't wish to frighten our viewers, but is there a possibility that these negotiations never really end? That if there is a deal, the EU will make it conditional by saying, all right, you can have this kind of state subsidy regime if that's what you want. We're not going to interfere. Here it is on fishing, here it is on other things. But we reserve the right regularly to come back to see if you're complying with the spirit and the letter of our deal. And if you're not, we will then reopen the matter or we will reduce the openness of our market to yours.
Oh, I think that's pretty inevitable. I mean, let's say we get a deal, and I hope we do, because I think it's a better world than a no-deal world. And no-deal world is a world of purgatory, because lots of things ranging from, you know, road haulage to electricity and gas to aviation to fisheries, in the end, you sooner or later have to sort in a legal deal. So I don't think no-deal is a terminus. You still have to solve things. What's going to happen then? The UK is going to say, well, we're sovereign and autonomous and free now. We want to do our own thing in our own way and legislate in our own interest. That's obviously what a government will do, what the House of Commons will do. There'll be occasions, and I suspect there'll be quite often, where the European Union side will say, but hang on, that's no longer convergent with the same purposes and delivering the same outcomes as we had agreed at the time we signed and ratified the free trade agreement with you. And if that's where you're going on this bit of environmental legislation or social legislation or taxation or subsidy legislation, yes, we will then retaliate and remove market access. And that's indeed what they're discussing a lot in the room at the moment. The circumstances under which you would be able to take the other party to arbitration and dispute resolution, and the circumstances in which you'd be able to retaliate against each other, and what that retaliation, what I know the British side is very fearful of, is what the EU has frequently used against Switzerland over the last 25 years, which is sort of cross retaliation, where they can hit you where it hurts outside the domain in which you've allegedly committed the offence.
I want to bring James in a second, just as we come to an end here, but let me ask you another question. Let's assume there's a deal. It's a bit scratchy, the negotiations don't quite go away, but Britain's on its own, off in some direction. The EU is there, unencumbered now by the United Kingdom. What I've not been able to discern yet is any kind of indication of what that means now for the EU without Britain always kind of holding them back. I don't yet see a direction for the EU, a more integrated EU, an EU that can go places that the British would have tried to stop them, either coming out of Paris or coming out of Berlin. Am I missing something?
Well, I think there's one area in which they've moved in a way they wouldn't have been able to do had we been there, and that is the recovery package on COVID, because they tied in that recovery package, which involves giving the European Commission massive borrowing powers and raising the so-called own resources ceiling, the amount of revenue that the union can raise as a union. They've done that deal and tied it in with their multi-annual financial framework, which is the jargon for their seven-year budget period. And frankly, any government I ever worked for would have vetoed that package. And because we weren't there...
And also, you're quite clear that the British, if we had still been in, we would have vetoed that.
We would have vetoed that under any government I ever worked for, Labour or Conservative, in my view. That is a change. They would have had, where I came in 2011 was when David Cameron tried essentially to stop the fiscal compact treaty and deliver a quid pro quo for the British side via that treaty. And the French and Germans decided to go round him and go via an intergovernmental treaty outside the treaties. And it's at that point that he decides they found a way round me and I'll have to go for an in-out referendum. I've tried to tell that story in one or two lectures I've given over recent years. We would have done the same and said, this is not acceptable. It's essentially a Eurozone fiscal package, not a European Union one. We don't accept a doubling of the own resources ceiling or the capacity for the European Commission to borrow on the markets, because the European Commission is now becoming a major borrower on the markets on a huge scale. I can't think of a British government I work for that would have accepted that. So that's the one area so far where you've seen a development, a big institutional development, where I think the European Union has done something or is in the process of doing something that it couldn't have done without us. Maybe they do some similar things on defence, where we were always the blockage. I personally was frequently the blockage or on preventing the Union doing things which we thought contradicted what we wanted to do under NATO. The risk for us is obviously that on both trade and financial services, they start behaving in a much more difficult way, which has impacts, negative impacts on us, even though we're outside the Union, because the centre of gravity of the Union has moved in a less British and less Anglo-Saxon direction, if I can put it like that.
Well, clearly it's not even over when it's over. Ivan Rogers.
Sorry that.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us on Spectator.
Thank you very much.
TV. Ivan Rogers there. James, just before we finish up here, let me just bring you in. Give us your update on where you think we are on the Brexit situation.
Well, I think, you know, both sides are moving, but they're moving in a kind of crab-like fashion, not a gazelle-like fashion. My understanding is there's been a bit of progress this week on the level playing field, but the two sides remain very far apart on fish. Now, the view has always been that these talks won't fail over fish ultimately, for the reasons that you outlined. But but time is getting short, and the two sides are so far apart on fish that it's hard to see that without a political shove from Boris Johnson, Ursula von der Leyen, maybe some other EU leaders intervening with Emmanuel Macron, offering to compensate the French within the CFP for losses that they would suffer under the fishing arrangement. You know, there has to be some movement soon. Now, we've now got talk of the European Parliament possibly being called into a special session on December the 28th to ratify the deal 3 days beforehand. You know, all of this is going to go right down to the wire. Ultimately, I still think there will be a deal, because when you talk about things like these, depending on which side you want to use, the evolution clause or the ratchet clause, the idea that if the EU were to toughen up its social laws, to take a hypothetical example, let's say it was to reduce the number of hours that can be worked under the Working Time Directive, and it could then take retaliatory action up to and including tariffs against the UK if it didn't do the same. You know, all of these are problems in the future. And I just wonder whether the two sides will basically agree to argue about that at a later date. I think the thing you are undoubtedly right about, Andrew, is that the UK and the EU will continue to negotiate for the rest of our lifetimes. You know, someone was saying to me in government the other day, you know, you can easily imagine a Labour government coming into office and saying, right, we will sign up to follow what the EU does on workers' rights, for example. The EU grants a little bit more market access. A future Tory government comes in and says, actually, we don't want to do that. And so they set about trying to unpick that in another renegotiation. I think UK-EU relations will always be with us. This is going to be a constant for the rest of our working lives.
Well, that's cheered me up, James.
I try to. Bit of festive cheer, Andrew.
Maybe on next week's Spectator TV, we'll be able to give you a more definitive idea of what has happened in the talks. That's it for this week. Thanks to our guests. Once again, to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. Don't forget our special offer. If you subscribe to The Spectator in our weekend flash sale, you'll get 12 weeks of the magazine in print and online for just £12. And we'll also send you a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch Whiskey. It's worth £30. To you, it's absolutely free. And it's that time of year where you can do with a bottle of whiskey. To become a subscriber today, go to spectator.co.uk/flash sale. You have to hurry. The offer ends on Monday. As always, please send us any thoughts you have on Spectator TV at spectator.co.uk. That's spectatortv@spectator.co.uk. We hope you'll join us again next Thursday for another The Week in 60 Minutes. Bye-bye.